Hello, I'm Cathy McDonald, and you're listening to The Practice of Reason. In this sequence of three lectures on war, we listen to philosophers discuss moral issues in the past, present, and future of warfare. Recorded live at the 2008 Australasian Association of Philosophy Conference, Melbourne. Here now is Dr. Jessica Wolfendale from Melbourne University with Torture Light and the Normalisation of Torture.
So what I want to talk about today is the use of the phrase torture light, which since 9/11 has turned up in public discourse about torture. So it's been used by journalists, by academics, and even by military intelligence personnel to distinguish between two different kinds of torture. Some of what I say will also apply to related terms like enhanced interrogation and stress and duress methods, but for purposes of conciseness, I'm going to focus just on the term torture light. Now, the term torture light, so it's used to distinguish between two kinds of torture. There's torture proper, which is violent, physically mutilating and brutal, and then there's torture light, which refers to interrogation methods such as extended sleep deprivation, noise bombardment, forced standing and manipulation of heat and cold, that are, it is claimed, less severe, more restrained and less physically violent than genuine forms of torture. So, for example, Joseph Lelyfield in the New York Times argued for the distinction between torture and torture light and claimed that techniques that fall in the latter category might be permissible. Mark Bowden in the Atlantic Monthly argued that torture light techniques might be justified in order to fight terrorism. And in The Guardian, a US naval intelligence officer called Wayne Madsen distinguished torture from torture light and claimed that only the latter techniques were being used in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. But this distinction between torture and torture light is not one that's recognised in any of the international conventions that deal with torture. And it doesn't directly refer to the distinction that is made in international conventions between torture and cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. So why then has this phrase torture light become part of the public discourse about torture? So in this paper I'm going to argue that drawing this distinction between torture and torture light is attractive particularly to liberal democracies because belief in the distinction bolsters what David Lubin has called the liberal ideology of torture, the myth that the use of torture can be compatible with the basic commitments of liberal states. So the use of the term torture light and related terms like enhanced interrogation enables the use of the methods referred to by these terms to be more widely accepted by the general public than would be the case otherwise, which is a consideration that is important for liberal democracies which rely on public support for their legitimacy. However, as I shall demonstrate, the distinction between torture and torture light does not refer to a genuine distinction in terms of the suffering of the victims or the cruelties of the methods. Like all forms of torture, the techniques referred to as torture light cause intense suffering and are extremely cruel. But I shall argue that these techniques are different from more physically violent tortures in a morally significant way. The language used to describe them and the techniques themselves encourage a moral analysis of torture in which the violence and cruelty of torture is denied, the victim's suffering is hidden, minimised and doubted, and the torturer's responsibility is diminished. Far from referring to an invariably milder form of torture, torture light refers to techniques, the use of which, combined with the justifications offered for this use, are likely to encourage the normalisation of torture and mask the extreme suffering that torture causes. The liberal ideology of torture. Modern liberal democracies are typically committed to protecting the value and dignity of the individual and to the restraint of political power. Now, since torture is a violation of human dignity, if anything is, and since torture has long been associated with authoritarian political regimes, most liberal democracies are signatories to international and local conventions banning the use of torture, such as the Geneva Conventions. David Lubin argues that this rejection of torture by liberal democracies stems from the recognition that torture is a, quote, microcosm raised to the highest level of intensity of the tyrannical political relationships that liberalism hates most. Torture aims to strip away from its victims all the qualities of human dignity that liberalism prizes. So the use of torture is in direct opposition to the liberal conception of the value of persons, the belief that each person, quote, possesses an inherent dignity regardless of their social situation. For a liberal democracy to use torture would therefore threaten the fundamental liberal democratic commitment to the value of persons and the restraint of political power. Yet despite this overt rejection of torture, liberal democracies, including the US, the UK, Israel and France, have used torture against their perceived enemies, both now and in the past. This blatant discrepancy between, on the one hand, the overt commitment to protecting the individual's dignity, and, on the other hand, the use of torture, cries out for justification. When liberal democracies resort to torture, the use of torture must appear to be justified in a way that separates torture from its traditional association with tyranny, so that the use of torture does not so obviously conflict with liberal democratic commitments. How is this achieved? According to Lubin, the liberal rejection of tyranny and cruelty as tools of political control means that liberal democracies accept that torture cannot be justified as a form of punishment or as a way of suppressing political dissent. However, there is one use of torture that does not appear to be necessarily incompatible with a liberal commitment to the value of human dignity, and this is torture for the purposes of gathering intelligence in order to prevent a serious threat to the state. As Lubin puts it, this form of torture, quote, torture to forestall greater evils, is the only use of torture that bears no essential connection with tyranny. Often the argument for torture is made using a variation of the ticking bomb scenario, in which torture is necessary to force a terrorist to reveal the location of a bomb that will kill thousands, even millions of innocent people, if it is not deactivated in time. In the ticking bomb scenario, the use of torture would be restricted only to cases that meet the extremely stringent criteria of the scenario. Torture would only be used against a guilty terrorist, never against innocent people, and the use of torture would cease as soon as the required information was revealed. The torturer in this scenario would not be some sadistic monster who delights in the suffering of his victim. Instead, the torturer would be an official, a conscientious public servant, in Lubin's phrase, who deeply regrets what he has to do. He is a kindly torturer, not a tyrant. When the use of torture is portrayed in this way, as Lubin notes, it becomes possible to think of torture as the last resort of men and women who are profoundly reluctant to torture. Now, as Lubin and others point out, this liberal ideology of torture is a myth. When liberal democracies do use torture, they do not restrict its use to cases that meet the extremely stringent criteria of the ticking bomb scenario. Indeed, it is doubtful that any cases just like the ticking bomb scenario have ever actually occurred. Instead, the overwhelming evidence demonstrates that when torture is used by a state, democratic or otherwise, it becomes an institutionalised practice, standard operating procedure, in the words of one torturer. This happened in the UK when British forces tortured IRA suspects. It happened in Israel, where despite attempts at legal control, torture became widely used against Palestinian prisoners. And it happened during the Vietnam War, when the US Phoenix Project became notorious for the widespread use of torture on suspected Viet Cong prisoners. More recently, revelations about the use of torture by US forces in Iraq, Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay paint a picture of widespread torture involving not only highly trained interrogators, but also psychologists and medical personnel, backed by the support of the US administration. Yet despite this evidence, the liberal ideology of torture persists in academic and public debates about torture. So the role played by the liberal ideology of torture in the discourse about torture lies not in its relationship to reality, but in the fact that it seems to offer the possibility that the use of torture could, in theory at least, be used in ways that are compatible with liberal democratic commitments. Even if in the real world, this almost never happens. By presenting this possibility, the liberal ideology of torture plays a central role in the public debate about torture by opening up a space in which torture becomes a legitimate topic for consideration by members of a liberal democratic state committed to human dignity and the restraint of political power. So what is torture light? The term torture light is used to refer to a range of techniques that, unlike more traditional forms of torture, do not physically mutilate the victim's body. Techniques commonly described of torture light include extended sleep deprivation, forced standing or stress positions, isolation, manipulation of heat and cold, noise bombardment and mock execution. The fact that torture light techniques tend to leave very little physical evidence on the bodies of victims makes these techniques particularly attractive to democratic states, as these states have a strong interest in maintaining public support and avoiding the attention of human rights organisations. As Lubin points out, democracies that use torture tend to use less obviously violent methods than were used in the past. As he says, there is a vast difference between the ancient world of torture with its appalling mutilations and the tortures that liberals might accept. Sleep deprivation, prolonged standing in stress positions, extremes of heat and cold, bright lights and loud music, what some refer to as torture light. Lubin notes that liberals tend to draw the line at forms of torture that maim the victim's body. This marks an undeniable moderation in torture, the world's most immoderate practice. Now, while Lubin explicitly rejects the liberal ideology of torture and the justifications for the use of torture, by characterising the shift from more brutal tortures to more non-physical techniques as an undeniable moderation in torture, he does seem to believe that torture-like methods are not as severe as more physically violent forms of torture. Other writers, such as Mark Bowden, share this view, the view that torture-like methods are all less severe than genuine torture, and that these methods are not as physically harmful as real torture and generally do not cause lasting harm. So the distinction between the methods referred to as torture-like and real torture also serves a further aim. So it is used to distinguish between types of torture methods and also between the character and motivations of torturers. Torturers who use methods like mutilations are clearly brutal and sadistic, but those who use torture-like techniques can be portrayed as professionals, Lubin's conscientious public servants, motivated by the need to gain intelligence essential for saving lives. So an example of this distinction is the difference between the US military's response to the torture at Abu Ghraib and the attitude taken towards the interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. The US military decried the abuse at Abu Ghraib, but there has been relatively little outcry within the military about Guantanamo Bay, where Army Major General Miller, who took command in 2002, was given permission to use techniques including sleep deprivation, stress positions, exposure to extreme heat and cold, and isolation. Unlike most of the abuse that took place at Abu Ghraib, which was sadistic and arbitrary, the torture practice at Guantanamo Bay is claimed to be part of a legitimate interrogation process, performed by trained military interrogators, assisted by medical professionals, and authorised by the chain of command. The difference between the military's attitude to torturers at Abu Ghraib and the attitude towards the torturers at Guantanamo Bay is clear from the decision to transfer the commander of Guantanamo Bay to Iraq to, quote, clean up the prisons there. So the distinction between torture and torture-like serves two purposes. It is used to distinguish techniques that are physically mutilating from techniques that do not rely on physical violence and that tend to leave few of any visible marks on the victim's body. Second, the distinction is used to track differences in the motivations and justifications for torture. Torture-like methods are used by trained professionals whose aim is to gain crucial information, whereas torture is used by sadistic and cruel torturers whose aim is to terrorise their victims. The Abu Ghraib torturers were sadists, but the torturers of Guantanamo Bay are conscientious public servants. But does the distinction between torture and torture-lite track a genuine distinction in terms of the severity of harm caused by these methods? Are torture-lite methods always or generally less harmful than real torture? Lubin is right to point out that torture-lite techniques do not maim or mutilate the victim's body, but he is wrong to conclude that this demonstrates a moderation in torture. Our judgment about whether an act constitutes torture should not focus on whether or not it leaves visible scars, but on whether it causes extreme suffering, and whether the torturer's aim is to cause extreme suffering. So what then are the effects of torture light? The use of terms like torture light implies that the methods referred to do not harm the victims as much as more obviously violent tortures. Yet the immediate and long-term impact of these techniques on the victims can be just as devastating as the impact of more traditional forms of torture. 14 Irishmen who were subjected to what was known as the Five Techniques food deprivation, sleep deprivation, hooding, noise bombardment and forced standing by British forces in Belfast in 1971, experienced extremely traumatic effects. Some of the men hallucinated. One saw his own funeral casket and heard hymns. Another man's tongue became so swollen he could not swallow. Another lost the ability to spell his own name. Some of the after effects of the treatment were horrific. One man lost the use of his hands, another lost his memory, and yet another could not stop crying and suffered from blackouts, intense headaches, insomnia and nightmares, and many other studies have found similar results. Now, of course, the long-term effects of any kind of torture vary considerably and are hard to quantify. The length of imprisonment, the environment in which the torture occurs, the victim's level of education, and the victim's access to support networks after release will all affect a torture victim's capacity to recover. But it is clear from the above studies that the widely held assumption that torture-like methods do not generally produce lasting and severe harm is just untenable. Indeed, the common belief that torture-like methods do not cause much physical damage is also highly questionable. Standing in a stress position for 18 to 24 hours, for example, has the following effects. Ankles double in size, skin becomes tense and intensely painful. Blisters erupt, oozing watery serum, heart rate soar, kidneys shut down, and delusions deepen. There is nothing merely psychological about these symptoms. It is equally difficult to dismiss the symptoms described earlier as psychological. Intense headaches, swollen limbs, and blackouts are all physical symptoms. It is clear that all forms of torture cause immediate severe harm and distress and are likely to have very serious long-term physical and psychological effects. It is therefore simply false to conclude that so-called torture-like techniques do not constitute real torture just because they do not involve obvious, immediate, visible damage. As I have argued, the distinction between torture and torture-like does not reflect a genuine distinction in terms of the kinds of suffering caused by the different methods of torture. Nor does the distinction reflect a genuine difference in the motivations governing the choice of these techniques. A state's decision to use torture-like methods should not be taken as good evidence of a motivation or desire to reduce the severity or cruelty of torture. Now, it might be the case that some of those who authorise or use torture-like methods might be motivated by the mistaken belief that these methods are less harmful than more violent forms of torture. But given the widely available evidence of the effects of these methods, it is hard to credit that those who authorise torture would be so unaware. And if they were so unaware, we would be justified in holding them culpably ignorant. At the very least, given the known effects of torture-like methods, the use of these techniques does not provide sufficient evidence to conclude that those using these methods are motivated by an aim that is morally preferable or more benign than that of torturers who use more violent methods. Furthermore, the history of the development of torture-like techniques indicates that one of the main motivations for the use was not to reduce the harm of torture, but to find more successful and less visible ways of breaking the victim. And torture-like methods proved to be very effective in this regard. CIA-funded research in the 1950s and 60s found that techniques such as sleep deprivation and forced standing were devastatingly effective in breaking down prisoners' mental and physical integrity. Drawing on this research, the CIA developed a two-step program of torture outlined in the Kubark Manual of Interrogation that combined the techniques of sensory manipulation and deprivation with self-inflicted pain. This latter technique involves forcing victims to hold physical poses for many hours. In the words of the Kubark Manual, it has been plausibly suggested that whereas pain inflicted on a person from outside himself may actually focus or intensify his will to resist, his resistance is likely to be sapped by pain which he seems to inflict on himself. This quote demonstrates that a key motivation for developing these forms of torture was not to decrease cruelty, but to make it more likely that the prisoner's resistance would be broken down. This strongly suggests that there is no prima facie reason to believe that those who authorise and use torture-like methods are motivated by a desire to moderate the cruelty of torture. The effects of torture-like are extremely severe enough to make torture-like methods clearly forms of torture. But this should not be taken to imply that there is no distinctions to be made within the category of torture. Torture is a threshold concept. Interrogation methods must meet certain criteria. For example, they must cause intense physical and mental suffering and be intended to cause such suffering in order to count as torture. But it does not follow from this that all torture methods are equally severe or equally cruel. Some torture methods are undoubtedly worse than others. But our judgment about the severity of a torture, of different forms of torture, should take into account factors such as the duration of torture and the immediate and long-term effects of the torture, not whether the methods used are torture-light methods or not. In arguing that torture-light methods meet the criteria of torture, it would be false to then conclude that torture-light methods are all equally as bad as the most violent tortures. Instead, the point is that our judgment about the severity of a torture technique is not answered by looking at whether or not that technique is a form of torture-light. The distinction between torture and torture-light doesn't mark a natural distinction between more severe and less severe forms of torture. But there is still a morally important distinction between torture-light methods and more physically violent tortures. This distinction is not a distinction in terms of severity of suffering, but a distinction in the moral psychology that is cultivated through the use of these techniques. The language of torture-light. By creating a false distinction between torture, understood as violent, brutal and cruel, and torture-light, which carries connotations of minimal harm, minimal force and minimal violence, those who authorise torture and those who carry out torture are able to portray what they are doing to themselves and to outsiders as not really torture, with all the negative connotations of that word, but rather a lesser form of enhanced interrogation. Terms like torture-light neutralise the violence of the techniques referred to and downplay the suffering that these forms of torture cause. Such euphemisms can have a strong impact on how those using these terms, interrogators, public officials and academics, perceive the morality of the techniques described by these words. When torture methods are described as torture-light or enhanced interrogation by torturers, public commentators and public officials, this encourages the belief that these forms of torture are all not as harmful or as severe as real torture, and so might therefore be more easily justified. This was Mark Bowden's view and Joseph Lelyveld's view. And that those who use these methods are therefore not as morally culpable as those who use more violent techniques. This distortion of the reality of the effects of torture-light means that the impact of these methods on the victims is very likely to be minimised, which contributes to the belief that such methods bear a lower burden of justification than real torture methods. The belief that what is being done is not really torture is further encouraged by the nature of the torture-light methods themselves. Torture-light techniques share two features that differentiate them from more physically violent tortures. First, many of these techniques sever the physical connection between torturer and victim, but is the hallmark of more traditional forms of torture. In a torture method such as a beating or a mutilation, the torturer inflicts physical violence directly on the victim's body, and so there is an immediate and direct link between the torturer's actions and the victim's pain. In contrast, many torture-light methods do not require the torturer to physically touch the victim. Altering the temperature of a room, or turning on loud music for many hours and keeping the prisoner in isolation, all do not require the torturer to be even in the same room as the victim. So this physical separation between torturer and victim departs from the traditional conception of torture as the infliction of pain, quote, one-on-one, deliberately up close and personal, as Lubin puts it. When using torture-light techniques, the torturer does not need to inflict pain, one-on-one, up close and personal, to get results. The torturer can be remote, impersonal, and in fact invisible to the victim. Second, unlike more traditional torture techniques, torture-light methods do not produce their effects immediately. It usually takes some time before these techniques begin to cause the victim severe suffering. Bright lights, loud continuous noise, isolation, and forced standing become unbearable gradually, whereas more physically violent methods cause immediate suffering. So this means that not only is the physical link between torture and victim severed, but the temporal link between the torturer's actions and the victim's pain is also severed. So the physical separation and the temporal lapse between the set of techniques and the effects on the victim can have profound consequences for how torturers interpret what they do and for how they understand their role in causing the victim suffering. A torturer who is brutally beating a prisoner cannot deny that he is violently assaulting another person with the intention of causing that person severe pain. Nor can he deny his responsibility for the victim's pain. His whole purpose is to produce that pain. But a torturer who uses methods such as bright lights and loud noise isn't hitting or maiming the victim, and the torturer may not even see or hear the victim's pleas or cries. So it is easy for him to pretend, to himself at least, that he is not attacking the victim. The distance between torturer and victim is likely to alter the torturer's moral assessment of what he is doing to the victim. As Thomas Nagel noted, our moral assessment of an action is affected by how it feels to do that action, what he called the moral phenomenology of an act. So how it feels to actually deliberately cause pain to another person, even to bring about good consequences, is an important element in our assessment of whether or not we should do so. So a torturer who has to physically assault the victim must find ways of reconciling the potential for emotional distress caused by torturing with the belief that the use of torture is justified, a process that can take some time. So as one Chilean ex-torturer explained, when you first start doing this job, it is hard, you hide yourself and cry. Later on you don't cry, you only feel sad. And after, not wanting to, but wanting to, you start getting used to it. There comes a moment when you feel nothing about what you are doing. Research on torturers has found that they use many strategies to enable themselves to feel nothing about torturing, such as dehumanising the victim, diffusing responsibility, and becoming desensitised to the infliction of pain. Elaine Scarry notes that torturers often focus intensely on the act of questioning. She says, the sheer and simple fact of human agony is made invisible, and the moral fact of inflicting the agony in question is made neutral by the feigned urgency and significance of the question. When torture-like methods are used, the fact of human agony is made even more invisible by the lack of visible wounds and by the physical distance between torturer and victim. The victim's suffering is hidden from view, and so it is even less likely to alter the torturer's assessment of the morality of their actions. As a result, torturers who use torture-like methods do not need to go to the same lengths to reconcile the belief that torture is justified with the potential distress of torturing, because they just avoid direct engagement with the victim. The torturer can therefore continue to see himself as a professional interrogator, carrying out an unpleasant job that has to be done, a job that can be described in terms that make no reference to violence, but instead focus more benignly on intelligence gathering or interrogation. Such a description of the torturer's role contributes to the myth that torture can be separated from cruelty and violence, and use only for, quote, legitimate forms of intelligence gathering. Now, the features of torture light that enable the torturer to deny responsibility for the victim's pain shift that responsibility to the victim instead. By severing the direct link between the torturer's actions and the victim's suffering, torture light methods encourage victims to feel responsible for their own pain. The indirect nature of torture-like methods mean that the victim's suffering does not seem to arise directly from the torturer's actions. There's no blows or fists or weapons. Instead, it appears to arise from the victim's inability to cope with the changes in his environment. The gradual impact of these methods means that the victim is likely to see the point at which they become unbearable as the point at which his body has betrayed him by its failure to bear the noise, the lack of sleep, the forestanding, the heat and cold, rather than as the point at which the torturer's aim is achieved. So torture-like methods work by turning the prisoner's environment and the prisoner's body into weapons against them. In Elaine Scarry's words, the prisoner's body is made to be an active agent in the process of torture. This aspect of torture-like reveals the deep cruelty of these methods. Far from always being more moderate and more humane than other torture methods, torture-like techniques not only cause extreme suffering, they encourage the victim to feel responsible for it. The term torture-like therefore both downplays the extreme suffering caused by these methods and hides the cruelty of these techniques behind a pretense of moderation and restraint. The cruelty of torture-like is further compounded by the hidden nature of the victim's suffering, which hides not only the visible signs of suffering from the eyes of the torturer, but also hides the evidence of torture from the victim's own community and from outside observers. Torture-like techniques torture-like techniques leave few, if any, physical traces on the victim's body. And this lack of physical evidence means that the victim's testimony about her experiences is more likely to be disbelieved. When physically violent tortures have been used, observers can see scars and mutilations, and this visible evidence communicates the experience of pain to others in a very visceral and immediate way. We just don't doubt that the victim suffered intense pain when those wounds were inflicted. But torture-light methods make that suffering invisible and internal. Observers cannot see the evidence of torture, and they must rely on the victim's description of her experiences. And so the difficulty in communicating the experience of pain is just compounded by the lack of physical evidence, which makes it easier for others to dismiss the victim's claims that they were tortured. As Darius Rajali argues, when torturers turn to covert torture, they deliberately induce a breakdown in one's ability to show one's pain to others, stripping their words of the marks that give the speaker credibility. This loss of credibility is compounded by the fact that the victims of torture, particularly in democracies, tend to be members of groups who are already ostracised and portrayed as suspicious or even dangerous. And this makes it easier for outsiders to deny that torture-light methods are really torture. And this undermines the victim's ability to seek justice. Attempts to prosecute torturers have been very seriously hampered when there is little physical evidence of torture. Now, torture-like methods protect the state that uses them by creating a barrier between the victim and their communities. The victim cannot prove they were tortured, and members of the victim community, as well as law enforcement officials and human rights observers, may doubt the veracity of the victim's claims. As a result, the victim of torture may not even find sympathy and understanding in her own community, let alone in the realm of international law. This consequence of torture-light highlights the way in which these methods are cruel in a way different from the cruelty of more violent techniques. To use techniques that cause extreme suffering and that encourage the victim to feel responsible for that suffering, and that mean the victim cannot rely on the support or belief of their community, extends the harm of torture beyond the victim's experience of pain to the victim's ability to recover, reintegrate into their community and seek justice. So torture-light methods are torture. Like all forms of torture, torture-light methods aim to break down the victim's mental and physical integrity, and these methods are extremely successful in achieving this aim. The difference between torture and torture-light lies not in the intensity of the victim's suffering, but in the moral attitudes and beliefs encouraged by these forms of torture and by the language that is used to describe them. The use of terms like torture-light downplays the harm of these methods and masks their cruelty. Torture-light techniques encourage torturers to feel less responsible for their actions. They encourage the belief that what is being done is not really torture, and they encourage the victim to feel responsible for their suffering, thereby undermining the victim's credibility in the eyes of their community. The language of torture-light, the use of this term, corrupts public discourse about torture by creating the illusion that there exists a special category of torture that is professional, restrained, and far removed from the brutal tortures of authoritarian regimes. This illusion allows the question of whether we should use torture to be replaced by the question of what kinds of torture we should use. The language and moral psychology of torture-light thereby perpetuates the myth that torture may be used in ways that are compatible with liberal democratic commitments. This contributes to the normalisation of torture and the minimisation of the suffering caused by torture. So in a world in which torture is being seriously discussed as a legitimate weapon in the fight against terrorism, such a consequence is deeply troubling. Thank you.
I'm Cathy McDonald, and you have been listening to The Practice of Reason.